Accession number 26803, Reel 5.
George Coe, Reel 5.
Right, about to describe the working conditions of a prose skyways. Before the LS started and I was sent on, I was on the normal runs to the Gulf with passengers to and from the oil companies. And of course, as I said, I was suddenly called in and we got on the airlift. Initially, I went out to RAF Wunnersdorf at the end of November and started the airlift soon after. The system was that we was proposed that the crews would go out to the airlift for 2 or 3 weeks, then come back to base at Dunsfold and have a spot of leave and then go out again. This was a time when we were approaching Christmas, and so they had to sort of think of a scheme to satisfy the people at Christmas time. So anyway, after 3 weeks or so approaching Christmas, I came back to Dunsfold for a week's leave. Then I had to go back. But if the air crews or any of the air crew people had children, then they were allowed to come back for the period of Christmas, then go back again later. Well, of course, although we'd been married just a short time, we had no children at that time. So we virtually came at the bottom of the list when it came to Christmas leave. So in fact, I went back and I flew to Berlin on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, Boxing Day, and the day after. But
were there any special festivities laid on?
Oh, I think so. Yes, I think we had Christmas lunch in the officers' mess. I think we had that laid on, and then of course, you know, we used the bar. It was quite reasonable. Without looking up my book, I can't remember the times that I was in Berlin on those festive occasions. But the fact is, I went there and back there. Eventually, of course, I came back, got my leave, and then went back again.
Can I ask you?
But
sorry. I didn't want to interrupt you. Did you mix much with the RAF
Civilians, we were ex-RAF, all of us, and there was no problem here. We dropped into the routine without any trouble at all. The only thing, difference, was that we were living in a hotel out in the country, whereas the other RAF people lived in the mess or the appropriate quarters. And that worked out very well. There was no difference of opinion or anything like that. So we carried on. Now, Skyways, of course, didn't always work on a regular rotor system. There was one period of time when my wife was expecting a child, and so I was allowed to come back, and then instead of returning immediately, I went back on the normal runs out to the Gulf. So it worked out very well. But as soon as Margaret had John, our child, then I was back on the airlift for a month or 6 weeks, I think. So it did work out very well. All in all, I spent, I think, three periods out on the airlift. I flew 84 lifts. That means I went to Berlin about 84 times. And after that, the airlift then suddenly began to reduce. Now, do you want to say anything there? Right. Now, of course, the first sign was that the Russians lifted the blockade, which was what it was all about in the first place. And the Russians lifted the blockade and allowed all the supplies and that to go in by road and rail, etc. The British side, however, were rather suspicious about all this, so they didn't want to be left with all the aircraft back home, and suddenly the Russians to be put the blockade back again. So they continued the airlift for two or three months after Russians had lifted the blockade. But eventually the airlift came to an end. In August of 1949, the civil airlift finished. That meant no civilians, and that was the end of it. So the aircraft then became gradually drifted back, but unfortunately there was a surplus of aircrew in the civil market. There were no jobs, no vacancies for aircrew at all, and companies then began to go into liquidation, etc. Skyways fortunately kept their bread and butter work going throughout the airlift, and so several of us soldiered on. However, the run seemed to, it started to run down, but my last flight, I was made redundant, and my last flight was on the 12th of September of 49.
Were you aware of the importance of what you were involved in at the time?
At the end, you mean, or the start?
During the airlift, were you aware of how important it was?
Oh, yes. I mean, we were keeping Berlin running. It was like starvation point. We knew that we had to fly supplies, or they had to be supplied. Otherwise, that would be it. We'd be in poverty, you know, there's nothing.
Were you aware of the wider political significance of what you were doing?
Well,
right
from the word go, there was always a political difference between the Russians, the Americans and the British. And that's how the trouble started, because of the political difference, how they were going to settle the post-war period. And there was always arguments to and from. So we were aware of the background situation, really. But that didn't affect our job. We just went there and back, after the other, and so on.
Did you have the opportunity to spend any time in Berlin during the blockade?
No, I didn't spend any time at all in Berlin. When you say Berlin, you mean the city?
Yes.
No, didn't have any time at all. Back at Wunsdorf, I did have a spot of leave, a couple of days, which I spent in Hanover. But as far as Berlin is concerned, I've never been to Berlin as a city.
Did you mix with any German civilians during your time at Wunsdorf?
Well, yes, we got, I think the aircrew got used to the loaders, who were all Germans, and we just used to pass time of day and, where possible, have a chat. They wanted to learn English, of course, and so we chatted a bit here, and so on. I did have one amusing incident, though, when I was in Hanover. Of course, at that time, younger, I had blonde hair. I was very fair. And some chap came up to me and gabbled to me in German. What he wanted to know where the so-and-so shop was. He thought I was a German because I was fair hair. But there was no troubles. There was no trouble. I felt sometimes that some of the Germans resented us. Naturally, of course, I mean, we'd knocked all their houses down, hadn't we?
So you returned to the UK in September of
1949. Yeah.
What happened to you after that?
1949. Well, I was kicking my heels. I was an experienced radio officer. And suddenly I got wind that GCHQ, that was the government interception service, were recruiting. So I applied for a job and got it. And I was posted, after a period at Bletchley, I was posted to one of their units. I don't think I'd better which one. I'm not sure whether I'm still obliged by the Official Secrets Act. But anyway.
I think over 50 years have gone by, yeah, I know. So I don't suppose it's still.
But anyway, I was posted to one of their units. And I spent about a year with GCHQ. The job actually didn't appeal to me very much. I had to learn Russian Morse. I know that. And after about a year, the pay was quite poor, really. But as a qualified radio operator, I think I was getting £6.10 per week. That's £6.50 a week. So, of course, I didn't like that at all. So, suddenly, the civil aviation people in England announced that there was to be new installations and that a radio range system called the National UK Airways were to be set up. This consisted of a number of aerials built around the United Kingdom, various spots, and these aerials would be energised with beams which produced the letter A or the letter N. If you were on course with the beacons, then you would get a steady audible note in the earphones. If you were one side or the other, you would get an N. Well, this was not unlike the airlift sort of procedure, but it was on medium frequency. And when introduced, it produced these legs, if we like to call them, along a certain prescribed route, which were called airways, and were coded amber 1, amber 2, red 3, red 4, and also. And so these system, which were copied from the pre-war American system, produced these beams. And as the pilot flew down the beam, it would pick up A or N accordingly. And on each beam were a system of fan marker, so that every, say, 30 or 40 miles, there would be a fan marker. which would indicate where the aircraft was in position to the ground, in relation to the ground. So at the same time, the VHF RT system was introduced, called the multi-carrier wave system, and it provided area coverage. And so, having introduced this system, the pilot could merely pick up his microphone, transmit to the centre, and talk direct to the air traffic controller who was controlling his flight. So, of course, this meant massive redundancies again. So,
because the radio officers were no longer needed. Radio officers were no longer needed.
Yes. Navigators were out, radio officers were out. That benefit the aircraft, of course, but that meant two extra seats for passengers. And so the system was introduced in early 1950, about 1953. It then gradually became augmented by ground radar, where you had a number of GCA, ground controlled approach stations, installed at various airports. So the massive redundancy continued. Fortunately, by introducing this system, it meant there was an expansion of the ground systems. So I applied for a job as an air traffic control officer, which I got. In subsequent months and years, I qualified as a GCA controller, a tower controller, an approach controller, an airways controller, the lot. The only thing I missed out on was computers. And so I moved around once, two or three sort of postings I got within the Ministry of Aviation, which is now called the Civil Aviation Authority. After a few years, I was asked if I would like to be an instructor at the School of Air Traffic Control at Hearn Airport, and which I did. It meant promotion to a grade one air traffic controller. And so I went to the college. I was in charge one stage. I was put in charge of training overseas students on the Overseas Airways course. I had about 26 people from all over the world, Caribbean, India, Africa, Norway, and I had the chaps to instruct a 6-week course on the airways system, that was the en route system. I'd be eventually ended up, strange as it may seem, back at RAF Uxbridge, where I've originally joined. And I joined a group of scientists in the CAA. We were investigating the delays caused departures at Heathrow, Gatwick and other airfields in the United Kingdom. I did a few years there. By that time I was approaching retirement age. That would be about 1957. And I applied for early retirement, but unfortunately I was just sort of too old for early retirement, as they said. as I was put back into an office job. This office job was very interesting. I worked with RAF squadron leaders, Royal Naval Air people, Lieutenant Commander, United Air Force, and I was a civilian. And our job was to protect the airspace against what was called unusual aerial activities. Now, we weren't concerned at all with the ordinary aircraft flying on these package tour there. What we were concerned with, many other flights which went on outside this system. For example, one I did was the flypast, the Royal flypast of the aircraft that flew up the mole over Buckingham Palace for the Queen's birthday. So I had to make sure the airspace was clear because that route was on final approach at Heathrow. Another one I did was the Norwegians were rather concerned about what they call the environment and pollution of the atmosphere. And they said that our power stations on the east coast were generating obnoxious fumes, as I said, and it was killing all their Christmas trees. Anyway, so the department then arranged for a modified Comet aircraft to be equipped with certain equipment which would detect these obnoxious fumes. So at an appointed time, the aircraft would take off, and it had a sniffer nose that was a long proboscis stuck in the front of the aircraft, and that would be our sniffer. And back in the power station, they would inject the coal station, and they would inject a radioactive isotope which would be ejected into space, and the sniffer would then fly up and down the North Sea trying to sniff out this obnoxious fuel. Well, that was the scope of the activity. I mean, it was unusual, of course, so it came under our jurisdiction, and we had to make sure that when it was on its run, that the airway system and all that would be kept clear. The aircraft that was flying up and down the civil airway system would keep clear. So that was another one. Another one was from Boscombe down, the inertial platform. The inertial platform was the start of computer link information, and it was a sort of electronic device which detected very micro movements of the aircraft, so that if the aircraft moved left, right, up and down, forward, backwards, these movements would be detected, and that would be part of the navigation away for future aircraft. And that was called the inertial platform system. And so that went on up in the Scottish Highlands, around the various islands. How far do you want me to go on?
So that was those were examples of the kind of work you
were doing. They were just examples, yeah.
And was that the last job that you had before you retired?
Yes, I did my final 3 years with what they called the airspace utilisation section, and I retired under normal terms at the age of 60, and that was the end of it. During my career, though, throughout, when I was an air traffic controller, at Manchester Airport. They also had these weekend flyers, a squadron of vampires that used to fly at weekends or odd days of the week. And associated with that group of flyers was a fighter control unit that was called number 3613 Fighter Control Unit. And I used to go at weekends or the odd day of the week to a military radar station, and that would be at Hat Green, and had an operations room near Preston. And the task there was for us. I joined this fighter control unit, and the task was to for interceptions. And the target aircraft used to take off for an aerodrome up in Wales, and the vampires used to take off from Manchester Airport, and our job was to do practice interceptions on this aircraft. So there I was. During the week, I would have my civil cap on, shall we say, and I would have to keep aircraft apart. At weekends, though, I would have my military hat on and bring the aircraft together. A very enjoyable time. I had about 2 or 3 years with them before then the whole of the military auxiliaries started to collapse, and that folded up as well. So all in all, I've had a very interesting career.